Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the three guilty verdicts in the second trial of Bill Cosby, who has fallen from grace as the beloved America's dad to facing the rest of his life in jail for drugging and sexually assaulting women. Deborah Turkheimer, a professor of law at Northwestern University School of Law and the author of numerous articles on rape and domestic violence, joins us to discuss what has changed in the intervening time between the last trial, which ended in a hung jury, and this one. We will assess the extent to which the Me Too movement has influenced the broader culture and thus the jury pool out of which the jury of 7 men and 5 women who convicted the 80-year-old Cosby came. We will also look into whether the new evidence presented was a factor in overcoming the defense, who attacked Cosby's main accuser, Andrea Constant, for having received $3.38 million in 2006 as part of a confidential financial settlement with Cosby. Then, with President Trump calling in to his favorite program, Fox and Friends, this morning, ostensibly to wish Melania a happy birthday, we'll examine the unhinged, paranoid rant that ensued, in which there was a fragmented and psychotic tirade against the press, James Comey, and Senator Tester, mixed with praise for Kanye West and the pro-Trump African-American social media personalities, Diamond and Silk. Dr. Bandy Lee, a forensic psychiatrist on the faculty of the Yale School of Medicine and editor of the best-selling book The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, 27 Psychiatrists and Mental Health Experts Assess a President, joins us. We'll assess the extent to which Trump is acting like a trapped animal lashing out and how, as investigations close in on him and his chaotic incompetence becomes more apparent, our dangerous president is likely to become more dangerous. Then finally, we'll speak with Li Fong, an investigative journalist with The Intercept, where his latest article is Secretly Taped Audio Reveals Democratic Leadership Pressuring Progressives to Leave Race. We'll explore how the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee does triage in deciding which of the many Democratic hopefuls running for Congress to back, and whether in trying to change red districts blue, by choosing conservative over progressive candidates, grassroots activists will be alienated and the candidates elected will end up voting with the Republicans. And joining us now is Deborah Turkheimer, who is a professor of law at Northwestern University School of Law and a former assistant district attorney in Manhattan. She teaches and writes in the areas of criminal law and feminist legal theory, and she is co-author of the casebook Feminist Jurisprudence, Cases and Materials, and the author of numerous articles on rape and domestic violence. Welcome to Background Briefing, Deborah Turkheimer.
Thanks for having me.
And today, in the second trial of Bill Cosby, he was found guilty on 3 counts. And it really is an extraordinary fall from grace. America's beloved dad now facing the rest of his life in jail for drugging and sexually assaulting women. What happened in the intervening months between these two trials, the first of which ended in a hung jury, do you think, Deborah?
Well, Me Too happened. That is a big and obvious factor that that people are talking about and should be talking about. We can also talk about ways in which the case looked a little bit different this time around. But I think the first point to make is that there was a massive shift in the conversation around sexual assault and sexual harassment. And this second trial took place after that seismic shift was underway.
And I understand that in this trial, 5 women, were allowed to testify. And I believe in the last one, only one was allowed to testify. Is that right?
That is correct. And actually, the one accuser who testified last time around did not testify this time. So these were 5 different women who the jury heard from this time, and that is a factor that very much distinguishes this retrial from the first trial.
But the defense in this trial did put up a pretty powerful case, at least in accusing the main accuser, Andrea Constant, and being quite ruthless in that regard. But the fact that she received $3.38 million in 2006 as part of a confidential financial settlement with Bill Cosby just to the layperson, that does raise questions.
Yeah, I think that the evidence of the settlement was used by both sides. For the defense, it was some indication that Andrea Constant had a motivation to lie about all of this. And to the prosecution, this was some indication that Bill Cosby had acknowledged some wrongdoing, paying this sum of money. I think at the end of the day, the jury may also have looked at the timing of all of this and recognized that this settlement had been paid out long before the testimony at trial. And Andrea Constant, as she sat and delivered her testimony in this case, had nothing financial to gain from the account that she gave the jury.
But do you see, though, this in a broader context, given what's going on with Michael Cohen, Trump's private lawyer, and Stormy Daniels, in the sense that she's getting out from under an NDA, and presumably Andrea Constant was able to get out from under an NDA? I don't know what the penalties were associated with that $3.38 million settlement. But there's something happening there. I mean, I don't know whether it's the Me Too thing or the revenge of those who have been gagged by NDAs.
Yeah, it may be both. I think that in this Me Too era, many people are taking a hard look at non-disclosure agreements, confidentiality agreements, and the ways in which the law has been used to keep survivors of sexual violence, sexual abuse, quiet. And so, you know, certainly when it comes to a criminal prosecution, there's reason to believe that that is extremely important information. And there are other reasons, too, to think that these accounts are important to tell and for people to hear. And so I expect that we're going to see some reform in the coming months and years with regard to this kind of secrecy surrounding sexual abuse.
But would this extend to corporate America? Because employees of corporations sign NDAs, and there's a lot of efforts, even I think all the way up to the Supreme Court, to get rid of class actions and move to these kind of settlement agreements that more often than not favor the more powerful over the less powerful.
Yeah, I think mandatory arbitration clauses and other kinds of contractual arrangements that keep sexual assault from coming to the fore and sexual harassment from coming to the fore, these are all under intense scrutiny now. And I think there is public pressure to take a good hard look at whether the cost of these provisions outweighs the benefits. I think for many people, the answer is no. The costs are just too high.
And again, I'm speaking with Deborah Turkheimer, who's a professor of law at Northwestern University School of Law and a former assistant district attorney in Manhattan. She teaches and writes in the area of criminal law and feminist legal theory, and she is co-author of the casebook Feminist Jurisprudence, Cases and Materials, and the author of numerous articles on rape and domestic violence. So, Deborah, do you think, though, this verdict and this trial will be sufficiently convincing for a lot of African Americans who are always skeptical about the fate of black defendants? By and large, they have very different experiences with the law and with the police than white Americans do. Often these experiences are quite bitter. As you recall, I think the wounds in many ways of the O.J. Simpson verdict are still alive, in as much as there are still African Americans who believe he was railroaded too. So is this case, do you think, sufficiently convincing, this second and successful attempt to convict Bill Cosby?
Well, I wouldn't make a prediction about how the verdict will be received. You know, I would say that sexual assault is a widespread problem. The criminal justice system has not historically responded well to this problem. And so for many victims and survivors in all communities, be they white, be they African American, Latina, I think there is real hope that what this verdict indicates is that there's some chance of justice in these cases for women who have been hurt.
And would it also indicate that all the money in the world can't necessarily buy you acquittal?
Well, it does. It does suggest that as well. I mean, I think that Bill Cosby's celebrity and certainly his fortune make this case different from the many cases that come through the criminal justice system. But obviously, it wasn't enough for him to escape this result, this guilty verdict.
So, when you mentioned earlier the Me Too movement. It does seem, though, that there still needs to be a greater and more resolute defense of women in general in our culture. This peculiar and disturbing incident that took place in Toronto, bringing to light this kind of so-called incel rebellion, which is the most hideous form of misogyny, the idea that these young men who spend too much time online and not enough time living life end up with this bitter resentment towards women because they can't get a date. And, you know, obviously there's an extreme result was mowing down all those women in Toronto. So it feels like there is a sort of permission out there for misogyny. And I think we have a president of the United States who's hardly a role model in terms of indicating a better way to treat women. What's it going to take? Does this verdict help? I mean, how do you see it in the broader context?
I think the verdict is a small piece of the conversation. I think it's significant. I think this is the first criminal justice moment in this Me Too era. Larry Nassar was sentenced in the Me Too era, but he pled guilty before trial. So this is, I guess, the first trial of a high-profile nature, and I think the criminal justice system should be very much a part of the conversation that we're having about our response to sexual violence. That said, it is a small piece of it. It's an important piece, but the conversation is a much broader one, and it's important that the conversation continue to span smaller transgressions to the very extraordinarily serious and tragic and awful. And while it is very important to draw distinctions and to categorize when we talk about what is at issue, we should also see the commonalities between these problems. We should see the commonalities between them. We should see the way they're related to one another. And that is part of what this Me Too movement, I think, is catalyzing, these kinds of conversations about all of the ways in which women are systematically mistreated and disempowered and violated.
Well, just in the last minute there, you don't have a more graphic example of the objectification of women being used as objects, as Bill Cosby is accused of basically raping comatose women. That is the ultimate in objectification, isn't it?
It is, and I think that the jury's verdict made that very clear as well. Andrea Constant was not consenting to being penetrated when she lay there immobilized, and that is an important statement, and it ought to resonate well beyond the bounds of that particular courtroom.
So do you think we'll reach a point where men and women communicate as human beings as opposed to in these hideous examples that we've just talked about, incel and the Bill Cosby case?
I'm an optimist, so I'll say yes. I think it's going to take a long, long time, and I think that we are at the starting point of a conversation that I very much hope endures and persists, and that we continue to grapple with this problem in a widespread way, in a collective way, in a deliberate way. That's how change is enacted. That's how we see real transformation.
Well, Deborah Turkheimer, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I'm speaking with Deborah Turkheimer, who's a professor of law at Northwestern University School of Law and a former assistant district attorney in Manhattan. She teaches and writes in the areas of criminal law and feminist legal theory, and she is co-author of the casebook Feminist Jurisprudence, Cases and Materials, and the author of numerous articles on rape and domestic violence. Going to take a brief station break back, assessing Trump's appearance on Fox and Friends this morning and assess the extent to which Trump is acting like a trapped animal lashing out. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Dr. Mandy Lee, who's a forensic psychiatrist on the faculty of the Yale School of Medicine, who served as director of research for the Center for the Study of Violence, co-founded Yale's Violence and Health Study Group, and leads an academic collaborators group for the World Health Organization. She was the lead organizer of the Duty to Warn conference at Yale University, out of which came the best-selling book, The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, 27 Psychiatrists and Mental Health Experts Assess a President, which she edited. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Mandy Lee.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, thank you, Dr. Lee. And today, this morning, Donald Trump, who is supposedly a morning person, as the Fox and Friends host said, he came on Fox and Friends, called into the show, and then he went on a 5-minute long rant, stream of consciousness, all of these grievances against Comey and the press, of course. It was an extraordinary display. In my sense, and at least my hunch, is that when we see these occasional glimpses of Donald Trump, we're actually seeing the real Donald Trump. Well, in this case, we weren't seeing him, we were hearing him. You recall in the lobby of Trump Tower when he went off about the Charlottesville Nazis and made all those incriminating remarks. Well, he sure made some pretty incriminating remarks on Fox and Friends, at least hung out his lawyer, Michael Cohen, to dry and admitted that he had spent the night in Moscow, which he had previously denied, which, of course, relates to the Steele dossier. So as a mental health professional, what was your verdict or response to this tirade?
Well, first of all, let me just clarify that I'm speaking for myself and not for my institutions, Yale University, Yale School of Medicine, or Yale Department of Psychiatry. And it's not just myself, but 27 mental health experts who contributed to the book, The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, and thousands of mental health professionals who have expressed their concerns and have come forth with their concerns in an unprecedented way. All of this is actually not very surprising to us because as mental health professionals, we are used to seeing various levels of mental impairment and signs of impairment. And we had been warning about this for quite some time because we apply the scientific knowledge, the research that is available. We know quite a bit about human psychology, and it's not that we can predict the future, but we can detect patterns that that make certain behaviors and reactions more probable than not. And we had been very concerned about the president's manifestations of mental impairment and difficulty coping with stresses such as ordinary criticisms or unflattering news, and now we have him in a situation where he has multiple stressors closing in on him, and so we are not surprised to see these responses. What we're most concerned about is the power that he holds in his office of presidency and the technology he has at his disposal, and the dangers of an impulsive act and the kind of dangerousness that entails. And so we've been very concerned about the personality structures he has shown, as well as his patterns of behavior and responses. And that's one of the reasons why we have come forth to try to alert the public and educate the public as much as possible.
So to sum up, Dr. Manley, you're saying that you have detected these exhibitions or signs of mental illness or mental instability, but as pressure grows on the president, he appears to be even more dangerous, and he does seem to be somewhat like a trapped animal lashing out. Is that what you detected in this outburst?
I think many, as you are describing, and many have commented as well, when someone becomes gravely ill or even terminally ill in general, it doesn't take a health professional to recognize that something is wrong, that the person is not well. I think in this situation, more and more people are recognizing that he is dangerous and not coping so well. We have watched him go through some psychotic spiraling in the past. In other words, losing touch with reality, going back to conspiracy theories, and he often goes into an attack mode when he feels threatened. And these are the responses that show the limits of his coping ability. And we are starting to see that now with the various accusations, the kinds of alternative realities that he wishes to assert, because the actual realities are troublesome for him and difficult for him to cope with. And so we've seen these patterns before. Even though we haven't examined him as we would a patient, we actually have a lot more information about him in terms of his reactions to situations in real time over extended periods of time. So in terms of dangerousness and in terms of potential risk, threat to public safety, we have a lot more information on him than we do of many of our patients. And so that is why we have been vocal about our concerns of his dangerousness.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Bandy Lee, who's a forensic psychiatrist on the faculty of Yale Law School of Medicine, who served as director of research for the Center for the Study of Violence, co-founded Yale's Violence and Health Study Group, and leads an academic collaborators group for the World Health Organization. She was the lead organizer of the Duty to Warn conference at Yale University, out of which came the best-selling book, The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, 27 Psychiatrists and Mental Health Experts Assess a President, which she edited. So this behavior that we're seeing, what I find extraordinary about it is that it's even destructive to Trump's own cause, if you will. I mean, he's often described as he was schooled by Roy Cohn in terms of being ruthless and that he's supposed to be very canny, etc. And maybe he is tactically occasionally, but some of the stuff that he said on Fox and Friends really undercut him enormously, both in terms of the Mueller investigation on what went on in Moscow in 2013, and also hanging out his own lawyer to dry when asked about why he was taking the Fifth Amendment. So how do you see that in clinical terms, that somebody actually hurts their own cause? It's as though he doesn't have the mental discipline to know what's coming out of his mouth.
That is right. Perhaps one contribution that mental health professionals can make is to make a distinction between those who are making their decisions out of a state of health, that is usually life-affirming, healthy decisions, versus decisions that are coming out of impairment and a lack of health. And what can often be seen as a brilliant strategy, for example, may not be the person's conscious, healthy decision-making. It could be a disorder that looks very strategic and effective because it's very driven. It's very, when the symptoms are severe, there's very little conflict in the person. And so they're actually driving toward destruction, self-destruction, destruction of others. And that's how we tell apart disease from health. So health professionals work from a medical model where we don't think in terms of left or right or in terms of ideology as much as we do in terms of health versus disease, life versus death. And the way we tell apart disease states is that it brings a person to damage and destruction and often death, suicidal, homicidal behavior. And that is something that it takes a specialist to recognize at times, because most normal individuals, the ordinary person, will think in terms of what they know, which is the wide variation of the normal range of human behavior, which is varied and rightfully extremely diverse, and there's a very wide range within health. But when it starts to encroach on unhealthy behavior and abnormality, then it is important for us to point it out. Otherwise, there's also the danger of it becoming normalized, being present in a person of such a powerful position. So whatever the president does has the danger of not only becoming normalized, but laying the groundwork for a culture of destructiveness and violence in some ways. You mentioned Charlottesville. In many ways, we now have the statistics as to how the mental health of the American population has been suffering. The stress levels are thought to be at the level that is lowest in terms of health in memory, worse than World War II, worse than the Vietnam War, the Cuban Missile Crisis, or September 11 terrorist attacks. So we're all suffering in a sense because of the abnormal pathology that is coming out of the office of the presidency. Now, Mr. Trump has not received an adequate evaluation. His own White House treating physician administered only a 10-minute cognitive screen and declared him mentally fit. And this is the same White House physician who has now been withdrawn from his nomination as Secretary for Veterans Affairs. And his lack of qualifications should also bring alarm to the fact that he had very little qualification to either examine the president's mental fitness and certainly not to be able to declare him mentally fit based on a 10-minute cognitive screen.
But how do you differentiate between Trump's mental state and what I detect as a fairly scary reality is that he's extremely uneducated about the world? Maybe he knows a lot about real estate in Manhattan, but, you know, when he talks about Kanye West and then suddenly goes into saying, you know, that Abraham Lincoln was a Republican. A lot of people don't know that. Well, a lot of people do know that. Maybe he doesn't. Right. He just learned right. it. So I'm trying to get a sense of whether, you know, where the fact that this is just a kind of accidental president who may have run as a lark to improve the brand name of Trump and just ended up through a series of circumstances becoming president of the United States and is just so woefully out of his depth that he's insecure and lashing out and overcompensating.
Sure. We were expecting that his whatever symptoms or signs that we were detecting would get worse under the pressures of the presidency. And that is indeed what is happening. Yes, there's a level of lack of competence and also having motives that may not be all that wholesome and altruistic, but there are also signs of pretty severe impairment, such as his impulsivity, his recklessness, his paranoid responses, where he perceives threats where they do not exist, or exaggerates threats or persecution. He has shown an inability to really have a firm grip on reality, possibly because there are many things he simply cannot accept. He's shown a lack of empathy. He's gone into rage reactions and having this constant need to burnish a sense of power. And when these, it's it's in a sense more of a matter of degree. When they enter into pathological levels, then you see the kind of responses where he cannot admit to not knowing enough to be able to function in his position or to take on a summit as important as with North Korea, or to carry out the presidency in general. So a capacity evaluation would evaluate whether or not he has the ability to take in and understand important information and advice, to process that information, to think about consequences, in order to make sound, logical, reality-based decisions. This is an ability that is critical to his office. And because of emotional reasons and because of internal needs, critical internal needs that he cannot place secondary to any other interests or concerns, such as concerns of the nation or the security of the citizenry, then that becomes a problem. We still do not know. In fact, there are so many reasons to doubt that his capacity to serve, his fitness to serve, will always be in question unless he undergoes a thorough evaluation.
Well, just in closing, the incredibly sycophantic hosts of Fox and Friends, it was almost like they were having too much of him. They seemed exhausted. In the end, one of them said, "We could talk all day, but it looks like you have a million things to do." Well, one would think so. You're president of the United States. But it doesn't. Is not the case. He spends up to 8 hours a day watching TV. He went off on Comey because he spent a lot of time last night, and perhaps at least an hour, watching the CNN town hall with James Comey and Anderson Cooper. So this is a man who, you know, I've used this analogy before, that if you were an actor, you'd be more interested in the reviews than the performance. And he spends most of his day looking at himself and his performance, or how his performance is being judged. Just to evaluate that in the last minute, if you will, Dr. Lee.
Yes, he has shown a pattern of having very little internal, a truly developed internal core where he can depend on, which he can depend on at times of uncertainty or criticism, and the level to which he has that missing has been very alarming. And in fact, that should scare us quite a bit, in that were his grandiose facade to crumble, the view of himself he wishes to project to others, and which he continually reaffirms for himself when he's talking about how much he won in certain states, how he won the difficult electoral college, and he goes over that again and again. That is because he is trying to prop up himself, where a true core is actually missing for what we can see. And that should be very frightening to us, because if his facade were to crumble, if he were to lose the support of his base, and if those who are loyal to him were no longer to adulate him and approve of him, then that brings us to a very scary place where he may go to any length to save his image, even by destroying all the eyes that are looking upon him.
Well, on that chilling note, I thank you for joining us, Dr. Bandy Lee.
Well, thank you for having me.
And again, I may speak with Dr. Bandy Lee, who's a forensic psychiatrist on the faculty of the Yale School of Medicine, who served as director of research for the Center for the Study of Violence, co-founded Yale's Violence and Health Study Group, and leads an academic collaborators group for the World Health Organization. She was the lead organizer of the Duty to Warn conference at Yale University, out of which came the best-selling book, The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, 27 Psychiatrists and Mental Health Experts Assess a President, which she edited. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into how the DCCC does triage in deciding which of the many Democratic hopefuls running for Congress to back following the release of an audio tape where the Democratic leadership pressures a progressive to leave the race.
Come on now. Who do you
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Lee Fong, who's an investigative journalist with The Intercept, who was the first to uncover and detail the role of the billionaire Koch brothers in financing the Tea Party movement. He's the author of The Machine, A Field Guide to the Resurgent Right, and he has an article at The Intercept, Secretly Taped Audio Reveals Democratic Leadership Pressuring Progressives to Leave Race. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lee Fong.
Thank you so much for having me.
And this is all about the blue wave and whether it'll crash and burn before it reaches November. So much of what we hear is optimistic in terms of the Democrats winning back the House and even challenging leadership in the Senate. And of course, there was a race in Arizona that the Republicans won, but rather narrowly. So the momentum seems to be in favor of the Democrats. But the real issue is, how much are they going to shoot themselves in the foot? And from your research, Lee, what do you think? I mean, are they going to go with moneyed candidates and safe candidates, or are they going to go with grassroots candidates who might inspire people to come out? I mean, that's what they're trying to navigate, I guess. But where would you say the preponderance of evidence is in terms of those choices?
Well, look, there's a few dynamics going on here. I think you look at the recent special elections, not just the Arizona one that you referenced, but in Pennsylvania, in Kansas, in South Carolina, in Georgia. Even when Democrats haven't been able to win these special elections, they've wildly outperformed expectations. And just taking a look at the data here, that would seem to suggest that there's definitely a large Democratic wave coming in this general election. The question is, what kind of Democrats will voters have an option of voting for? There's an effort by the Democratic establishment and Democratic leaders, including folks involved with the DCCC, that's the Democratic Party arm, involved in electing members to Congress, to recruit business-friendly moderates with very bland policy positions who have access to a large amount of money as the frontline Democrats in key races. Now, the danger here is that, one, that some of these candidates are too safe and they don't excite voters and they actually underperform. And then there's the larger kind of policy question and existential question for the Democratic Party. Are these candidates truly representative of the demands of the base, of folks who are demanding change? Will they help Democrats fix the big problems in society, whether that's on health care or climate change, on jobs and inequality, and the list goes on. So there are many dynamics going on right now, and there's a big push by the establishment to ensure that the type of Democrats that are nominated are these kind of centrist, business-friendly folks.
But if you're running as a Democrat in a red district, as happened, or at least one that's represented by Republicans, then isn't the logic that you would have to have a centrist Democrat? Because if it's a predominantly Republican-leaning district, a liberal Democrat wouldn't have a prayer.
Well, that's been the conventional wisdom of the Democratic Party for the last 30 years or so. But we've seen in example after example that voters, even in Republican-held districts and kind of moderate-seeming suburbs, voters, especially in midterm elections, aren't particularly excited by these type of candidates. The DCCC, in the last election, viewed as a big Democratic wave midterm, in the 2006 election, the Democratic Party targeted these kind of bland centrist candidates and hoisted them up. Many of those candidates, by the way, lost their general election. And in some cases, you had progressive candidates winning their nomination, and that really angered the establishment. Folks like Carol Shea Porter in New Hampshire, an anti-war activist, John Hall, a musician in New York, and Jerry McNerney, a clean energy executive in California, they won their nomination despite the DCCC backing their centrist opponent. The DCCC refused to support them in the general election against Republican incumbents, you know, very well-financed Republican incumbents, and those progressive candidates ended up defying all expectations and winning their election. So, you know, we have a long history of the DCCC recruiting moderate centrist candidates, those candidates actually losing, and progressive candidates that are outside of what D.C. insiders see as an acceptable candidate, receiving very little financial or political support and ending up winning. You know, it's not very clear that the DCCC really understands what exactly voters respond to. And, you know, there are a lot of intelligent, very hardworking people involved in the Democratic Party, but a lot of this is also pay to play. You know, they're looking for candidates that will keep the lobbyists and corporate PAC money flowing to the party, who can self-finance or can tap into their own network of wealthy individuals. And so they care more about the money in some cases rather than quality candidates.
And again, I'm speaking with Lee Fong, who's an investigative journalist with The Intercept, who was the first to uncover and detail the role of the billionaire Koch brothers in financing the Tea Party movement. He's the author of The Machine, A Field Guide to the Resurgent Right, and he has an article at The Intercept, Secretly Taped Audio Reveals Democratic Leadership Pressuring Progressives to Leave Race. And I guess the final point to follow up on what you're saying, Lee, is that if you elect a centrist Democrat or even a right-wing Democrat, like, for example, Joe Manchin in West Virginia or Heidi Heitkamp, you may end up finding that that person will vote with the Republicans more often than not. Now, I understand the logic of getting to the majority status, so you need to get as many Democrats as possible so that you're in the majority. But is that a factor to be concerned about? In other words, if they're so conservative, what's to stop them from voting with the Republicans?
Well, in those two examples that you gave, you know, those are very Republican states. And, you know, I think that folks like Heitkamp and Manchin have really angered the progressive base with a lot of their votes. There are other examples that I think are actually much more confounding for the Democratic Party. There's folks, previously elected members like Albert Wynn and Ellen Tosher. These are from deeply Democratic districts, very liberal districts that were tied in with leadership. You know, these are districts that a Democrat would win no matter what, but they would support a foreign war. They would support the deregulatory agenda. They would vote often with Republicans. And so, you know, you have it's not so simple as just the kind of partisan dynamics of any district or state. A number of Democrats who are elected from deeply Democratic districts who are recruited by the New Democrats, this is a centrist group, or the Blue Dog Democrats, this is a conservative group within the Democratic caucus that is backed by big business. Many of these folks are simply voting with the Republicans or voting with the Republican agenda. So, you know, the money makes a big difference. The individuals make a big difference. Some of these red state Democrats are essentially outliers. They vote Republican only or largely in election years. But the reason why certain individuals vote with the Republican Party or vote with a conservative agenda isn't necessarily tethered only to whether they're from a blue or red state.
Well, let's go to the tape in a minute here. I just want to set up the tape of where Steny Hoyer, the number two Democrat in the House, is urging Levi Tillerman, an author, inventor, and former official with the Obama administration's Energy Department, who is running in Colorado's 6th District, he's urging him to drop out because the DCCC have decided to put their weight and money behind Jason Crow, a corporate lawyer at a big Colorado law firm and an Army veteran. And this is Colorado's 6th. So, incidentally, Lee, a good friend of mine, was originally approached by Nancy Pelosi to run in this race, but he turned them down. But the long and the short of it is, this is evidence of the kind of discussions that go on where the DCCC, the Democratic Party, tries to convince progressive candidates that they should bow out. Let's play a little of that tape.
Yeah. I know you're fundraising for Crow.
Yeah.
You know?
I'm for Crow because a judgment was made very early on. And I just made the decision.
So your position is a decision was made, you know, very early on before voters had a say. That's fine because that's the DCCC knows better than the voters of the 6th Congressional District, and we should line up behind that candidate.
That's certainly the consequence of our decision.
And that, of course, was a tape, a conversation between Steny Hoyer, the number two Democrat in the House, urging Levi Tillerman to drop out of the race for the 6th District primary on the Democratic side in favor of Jason Crow, a corporate lawyer and Army veteran. So, I mean, I understand from the DCCC's point of view, they've got a limited amount of money and they've got to spread it over a number of races, and it's a form of triage that's going on here. Is there, though, a case to be made? Here in California, there's a number of races where there's an awful lot of Democratic candidates, and they all are raising money, and wouldn't it make sense to be able to go through some form of triage? I don't know how you finesse it, but is there a tendency or a propensity to waste a lot of money in these primaries where you have a whole bunch of people running against each other, which soaks up the donor pool, and by the time you get to the general, there's no money left?
No, I understand that concern. California is a special case because they have a very special election system, the jungle primary, the top two primaries. So there is the danger that Democrats are spread too thin, and that in some of these competitive seats, because of the jungle primary, you'll have two Republicans running against each other with no Democrat on the ballot if the Democrats divide the vote in such a way. That's kind of a particular concern for California. But across the country, we're seeing these dynamics play out where the DCCC is going in very early. I mean, as early as January and February of 2017, of last year, and selecting a candidate behind closed doors and deceptively telling every candidate that's entered the race that they are remaining neutral, that they are not playing favorites, when in fact they went in early and selected one candidate, typically a centrist or a conservative Democrat, someone with access to a lot of money, and they've funneled resources, PAC money, candidate training, polling data, you know, all the tools you need to win to their pre-selected candidate. And I think there are a few issues that are raised here. One is just the issue of fairness and honesty. Why have they been lying to these candidates and to the public and claiming they're neutral when it's clear that they are not? The Colorado case is special because one candidate decided to record this conversation and fight back publicly. But we've heard similar anecdotes from races all across the country, in Pennsylvania, Minnesota, Texas, Nebraska, really just all over the country. We're hearing similar stories as what happened in Colorado. And second, you know, how do we, again, coming back to our earlier conversation, how do we know that these pre-selected establishment candidates are really the strongest, most viable candidates in the general election? You know, if from the Democratic Party's perspective, I understand the need to kind of triage the money and find the strongest candidate to beat a Republican in the general election. But as we mentioned before, they have a very poor track record. A lot of the centrists that they've selected in the last election and the previous election, you know, going all the way back for the last decade, these centrist candidates have lost over and over and over again to their Republican opponents in these very suburban districts or these targeted districts that are coming up in this year's midterm election. So, you know, the DCCC is not only potentially crushing the kind of Democratic values, the small d Democratic values of the Democratic Party, but also potentially shooting themselves in the foot by simply selecting a candidate who has close ties to the party or can raise the most money, but might not have the largest grassroots organizing base, the biggest volunteer base, or has the policy issues and the vision that can really inspire voters.
Well, let's apply what you just said to this example where the candidate, Levi Tillman, recorded the the Dear John meeting with Steny Hoyer, telling him to drop out and that they were going to support Jason Crow. Levi Tillman, his campaign was running on clean elections, combating climate change, and Medicare for all. What is the favored DCCC candidate, Jason Crow? What's his campaign agenda?
Well, Jason Crow, he's been running since April of 2017. Almost for the first year of his campaign, he had no issues page. He took no position on any major issue. When you went to his website, it just had a little biographical information that he had served in the Army, that he works as a lawyer, that he's advised various Democratic politicians on veterans issues. But, you know, for almost a year, voters did not know where he stood on any major issue. And, you know, this is a candidate that, even with no issues page, received endorsement after endorsement from local Democratic groups, local Democratic politicians, other organizations. And, you know, in recent weeks, in recent months, he's put out very aggressive advertising and positions on gun control, saying that, you know, that's one of his top concerns if elected to Congress, which I understand is a very important issue within the Democratic base, and especially in Colorado. You know, that sixth district covers Aurora. That's the suburb where there's a very deadly mass shooting not that long ago. But again, you know, this is a politician who is now claiming that, you know, they don't take corporate PAC money, although that claim is questionable. That they do support the Democratic agenda. They haven't put out, the issues page is now updated on their website, Jason Crow. We haven't seen really just a detailed take on where they stand on major issues like climate change or healthcare.
So how do you see a coalition forming? Is this really a case of, you know, I did a forum recently at the UCLA Hammer forum I do every month. We had Congressman Ted Lieu, who is on the DCCC committee, by the way, and Harry Littman, a former deputy attorney general, and we're talking about the Mueller investigation. But so many people in the audience said to me that just hearing a progressive Democrat give such an optimistic message was so heartening because people are so depressed on the political left by what's happened to the country. So what would be the best strategy? On the one hand, to inspire the depressed left in this country, at the same time, win over the disaffected Republicans. I don't know how many traditional Republicans are left because the Tea Party has clearly taken over the Republican Party, and this is now Trump's party, and it's extremely ugly. So is there enough of a constituency of disaffected Republicans that you need to woo to move to the center? Or is this just a case where there's so much anger on the left that you don't have to move to the center?
Well, look, I mean, I don't have an easy answer to any of those questions, and I'm not sure if anyone does, but I think it's instructive to just look at the 2008 campaign of President Obama. You know, when he was running as a candidate, he promised to shake up the establishment, to get money out of politics, that he would crack down on lobbyists, that he would fight for universal health care, he would tear up NAFTA, you know, he'd get rid of these bad free trade deals, he'd address climate change. You know, he kind of ran as a populist, including reaching out really in a focused way, not just in the kind of traditional Democratic base of urban areas, but reaching out to suburbs, to rural areas. You know, people forget that when Barack Obama won his historic election in 2008, he even won Indiana. He came very close to winning states like Missouri. You know, he did very well in the rural and post-industrial areas of the Midwest. And that's because he had a very broad, I think, populist message. Now, when Democrats came into office the following year in 2009, they didn't deliver on most of those promises. They did manage to pass the Affordable Care Act, which is a much watered-down version of what President Obama was talking about in the campaign trail. But for a lot of those other big promises that really kind of increased voter turnout, increased voter registration for that very special year of 2008, since then, it's been over 10 years now, or about 10 years now, there's been incredible alienation with the political system, and I think Republicans have done a very good job of tapping into that alienation and anger and channeling it in another direction. The question for Democrats is, can they revive that spirit of 2008? In the candidate recruitment that we're talking about for the congressional election, again, can they replicate the energy and enthusiasm that Obama inspired? And once they elect candidates that carry a large reform agenda, will they deliver? I mean, the big problem with Obama's first 2 years is that many of the Democrats in Congress who were supposed to carry out his progressive agenda refused. You know, some of these folks watered down bills or voted against Obama agenda items. And then when they either retired or were voting out of Congress, they took million-dollar pay cuts working for the very industries they were supposed to regulate and reform. You know, Evan Bayh, the senator from Indiana, blocked labor union reform, left Congress, and then went to work as a lobbyist or in the lobbying division of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the biggest big business group that was fighting labor reform. Keith Schuller, congressman from North Carolina, who helped water down action on climate change, left Congress and became a lobbyist for Duke Energy. You know, this is a coal-fired utility industry group that opposed clean energy action. So, you know, a lot of these Democrats
refused to act on their promises and then cashed out, went through the revolving door and took big paychecks. You know, that's not to be nihilistic, but, you know, I think folks have to realize that there are so many dynamics in Washington, D.C. that lure the Democratic Party away from its own principles.
Well, just in closing, Li Feng, you know, when you talk about having conservative Democrats run in conservative districts, maybe the Democratic Party should learn from what's happening now with the teacher strikes in these red states. And today in Arizona, 50,000 teachers and their supporters converged on the state capitol. And surely this shows that the so-called white working class that went for Trump in the last cycle, they just need to be mobilized by the right message.
Well, you know, I would just leave it here and say that in West Virginia, one of the states where we've seen these huge teacher strikes, one of the leaders of that strike movement was Richard Ojeda, you know, former paratrooper, a very working-class guy, a state senator who represents the southern area of West Virginia. He's running for Congress in one of the most Republican, most Trump-supporting districts in the country, and he hasn't compromised any of his values. You know, he's talking about getting money out of politics, about establishing true universal health care, bringing health care costs down and making it truly universal and accessible. And he's running a very kind of spirited, essentially angry campaign talking about the need to fight the establishment in a way that I think it's really resonated with voters. You can see just demonstrated in the way that he helped lead the teacher strike. And in his campaign for Congress, he uses rhetoric that's actually far more left-wing in certain respects than folks who are running in safe Democratic districts.
Well, Li Feng, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Li Feng, who's an investigative journalist with The Intercept, who was the first to uncover and detail the role of the billionaire Koch brothers in financing the Tea Party movement. He's the author of The Machine, A Field Guide to the Resurgent Right, and he has an article at The Intercept, Secretly Taped Audio Reveals Democratic Leadership Pressuring Progressives to Leave Race. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon, assistant producer Kathleen Ash. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.